Bonjour. Hello, everyone. Normally at the beginning of the pod here, we start a bit with a bit of a light bit, but considering all the events in Manitoba and Winnipeg involving the trial and the deaths of four Indigenous women, we're decided instead to just honor their memory and recognize their lives and their families, and also send our love out to all of the communities and individuals who've been impacted by this. So we want to honor the lives of Rebecca Contois, Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, and Mushkede Bijiki Ikwe, our Buffalo Woman. Miigwech, thank you.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Nigan and the Lone Ranger. With your hosts, Nigan Sinclair and Dan Lett.
This past week in Winnipeg, we've sort of seen the culmination, not the culmination, but the trial of the man accused of killing four Indigenous women has sort of finally started to take place. And it seems like, you know, we've lived with this story and some people obviously living with it like in a, just in a nightmarish fashion for so long. It almost feels weird that we're actually...
We're actually here right now and we're sort of watching it in real time.
So to date, most of what's happened has been procedural. But there are, there's a couple of really important developments that, you know, we think listeners of the podcast and really all Manitobans should know about, but also that we want to explain because there's some confusing stuff going on. So two important developments. Number one is there was a motion put forward by defense to only do the trial by a judge and not a jury. And actually, as we're recording this podcast, there's news on that front.
Yeah, the Justice Joyelle, head justice, rejected the defense's motion, and it will be held with a jury.
So the question would be, why would the defense team, and there's a team of three legal aid lawyers who are defending Jeremy
Skibicki.
Why would they seek a judge alone? And that actually dovetails directly into the other big issue, which is they've served notice that they will proffer a defense that their client is not criminally responsible, or NCR, the known in legal circles, for the murder of the four women for which he's accused. And NCR, I've written quite a lot about NCR. I wrote quite a lot about it in the context of the Vince Lee case. He was a man in the grips of a horrible psychosis, a mental health condition, when he decapitated a man on a Greyhound bus west of Winnipeg. You know, we've written quite a lot about it in the Winnipeg Free Press, but it's quite a misunderstood concept, and even rarer to be applied in a case of an alleged serial killer.
And there is so many things. I mean, two things have happened as a result of this motion or this intention by the defense to use this non-criminally responsible defense. It's really inflamed a lot of trauma in the Indigenous community, because if this is the defense that's going to be put forward, it really brings up a lot of issues involving previous trials that people have been found not guilty, but then also some of the flimsy excuses or flimsy approaches or flimsy defenses that people have used that have generally gotten success in the past. And so there is a real paranoia in the Indigenous community that has been very noticeable in the past 48, 72 hours that I have noticed. Yep. And that have certainly, social media is no linchpin, but certainly I see it a lot. People very inflamed, very triggered, very traumatized mm-hmm. by this defense. But then also has brought up the bigger issue of, would this have worked? And is there a reason why they wanted the single judge versus a jury trial? Would that have something to do with the fact of why they put this motion forward?
Well, I think it's – I'd almost rephrase it and say that they've decided on the NCR defense because – and this is – I'm now kind of – I'll rely upon a number of conversations that I had, both with experienced private bar criminal defense attorneys, some people – connected to law enforcement, nobody involved directly in the case, but people who can decode a lot of what's going on. So NCR, you know, not criminally responsible defense. And I'll just read so NCR is a section of the criminal code. It's section 16, and it states that a person can be found not criminally responsible for a crime if they were suffering from a mental disorder at the time, and here's the fundamental part, the mental disorder made it possible for them to understand the nature and quality of what they did, or the mental disorder made it impossible for them to understand what they did was morally wrong or legally wrong. Now, in cases where it has been successfully used, it's usually in a single horrible, violent, tragic event, like the Vince Lee case. It's almost never any country that relies upon English common law. It's almost never used as a defense for someone accused of serial killing because there is a deliberate, repeatable, behavior. Where horrible crimes are committed, and then there's an effort to cover them up, and it goes on many times for years. That's not to say that serial killers do not suffer from mental health problems. It's almost universally accepted that someone who can engage in serial killing would have some sort of, but are they to the point where they can't tell right from wrong? Repeatedly over and over and over again? No. So it's a very rare application of this section of the criminal code, but that in part is why they wanted the judge alone, because it's a bit of a reach, because all the defense attorneys I talked to said there is no way NCR is going to fly with
multiple people,
with a jury of citizens. Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to talk about the facts of the case because we don't know yet. I mean, we are a number of days away. The arguments start on May 8th. But the details around this case, if just by reporting alone, are horrific and are going to be touched upon. And everything from white supremacy, which has mm-hmm. been well known. We documented that in the Free Press, that he was a well-known supporter of white supremacy, according to his social media.
Misogyny.
A lot of anti-residential school stuff on his social media. My colleague Sean Carlton at University of Manitoba uncovered that for us, and we wrote about that. But then on top of that, the fact that he was alleged to have sort of went to homeless shelters searching out. And it wasn't just about these four women, but also about dozens of other individuals, women particularly, who were allegedly offered reasons, drugs, so on, to come to his place, shelter. And that therefore then led to other instances of exploitation, because this individual has a long history, or a fairly documented history, of abuse of a previous partner and things like that. And so there is a ton of issues that are coming to a head that are kind of been leading for decades mm-hmm. into this one case in Manitoba. And so it's hard not to sort of just feel the heaviness of all of this.
I think getting back to the NCR thing for a moment, no doubt, it's a controversial part of the criminal code. You know, I can tell you, even in cases where it is clearly the correct, assessment of a criminal act, I should also say parenthetically, NCR is not the not guilty by reason of insanity language that we know from the United States. Although you may not be found culpable for a crime, the more serious the crime, the longer that you will be held in a secure psychiatric facility. There are some people found NCR who get out after a few years. There are others that literally have died in a psychiatric facility after two decades or more of incarceration, never having been found mentally secure enough to be released. The reason, what can we say, or what can we read into the case? And this is where I think it connects to the landfill issue. So the lawyers I talked to find the NCR defense to be a bit of a Hail Mary. And they do think that this probably reflects on the strength of the Crown's case against Skibicki. Now, this is not to say that there won't be problems with it. And I should say, in cases involving murdered Indigenous women and girls, we have too often seen bad prosecutions, bad police work, that was brought to trial, and then the whole thing flopped. In this particular instance, though, I think it is a Hail Mary by the defense team, and it is a reflection of the strength of the evidence, which kind of perversely, I think, also explains why the Winnipeg police abandoned the idea of searching the landfill. It's because they felt they had a strong case. They never connected the cultural, spiritual, symbolic.
What a badly thought through. I was having breakfast with a federal minister, and that federal, I won't say the name of that federal minister, but that federal minister expressed concern to say how the issue, because just this week they've announced a landfill search in Saskatoon, which is already underway. Which is what the police should have done in the entire first place. The fact is that when human remains are at a landfill of anyone, there should be an attempt to search
right away
without getting the public involved. Yep. Almost. I mean, you should inform the public, but it should be almost an after the fact. So if you want to see a template of how it should be done, watch Saskatoon at the moment, or watch this, what's happening in Saskatchewan. There's remains allegedly found, allegedly in a landfill. They have a decent amount of evidence to support that. And they went in and searched, and then they told the public about it and said, oh, let you know that this is what we're doing and give you some information around this. What the Winnipeg police did is frame this as a feasibility issue. And this goes directly at the feet of Chief Danny Smythe and all of the others, individuals who use the term feasible along the entire way too, which is directly what led to the politicalization, but illustrates, I think, a kind of a distance between the ways in which this issue was seen by police, but also the ways in which they completely underestimated the way in which this would be seen by humanity, but also particularly the Indigenous community.
No, for sure. I mean, again, I think early on when they realized, A, they had a lot of physical and other evidence supporting the charges against the accused, but that that they didn't need, let's say, intellectually, they made the decision that they didn't need remains from a landfill, and they checked out on that whole idea. I think that, the feasibility argument was really frustrating because there was the 10,000 loads of garbage, anecdote that 10,000 loads of refuse had been placed since they think that the remains went there. Well, yeah, but that's more of a you problem than a me problem because, if you had acted right away instead of months later admitting that you were pretty sure the remains were there, that wouldn't be as much of a problem. Getting back to the trial, when you combine NCR, which is a pretty desperate plea, with the behavior of the Winnipeg police, what it adds up to is a scouting report that suggests that the case is very strong against him. I think the further miscalculation, though, is that if that evidence results in a quick and clear verdict that finds the accused guilty, and we're not presuming that it will, but if it does, I think police theorized that that was going to calm all the frayed nerves that we
and
got.
And that's in no way going to happen because, of course, we have a search the landfill project happening in somewhat of a limited fashion happening this summer, maybe this fall. There's the possibility not just of either finding remains or maybe other remains. The other possibility is that, let's say there's nothing found.
Yeah.
And then will that money that is not the $180 million, but $40 million, will that be enough to be able to start a conversation on commemoration or will it not? Or this issue is not coming to a close in any way.
Do you think Saskatoon is influenced? In the 100%. Wake of what happened here? Yeah,
100%. And I say that because you just look at the way in which the Saskatchewan government has handled this. I mean, on every barometer, the mishandling of Indigenous issues in Saskatchewan and Alberta is well documented. But the fact that they are now the model of how to handle this issue is indicative that they're learning from the problems that were created here in Winnipeg.
You know, a perverse positive outcome from a horrible event, it doesn't make the event less horrible. But it is somewhat encouraging that people looked at what happened here and in the election and said, we're gonna get out in front of this one. We're not gonna
or maybe just see people as human beings. Like
yeah,
like that. My optimistic approach is that hopefully you know, Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit peoples, that they're seen as human beings and treated as such.
So that's a great segue into today. We're lucky enough to have Cabinet Minister Bernadette Smith on the podcast. She is the Minister of Everything.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. The longest cabinet portfolio of all time.
Mental health, addictions, homelessness. And then, oh yeah, by the way, no, sorry, I got it wrong. Sorry. This is me looking up the exact, you know, cause this is a mouthful, man. Here we go. Minister of Housing, Addictions, Homelessness, and Minister Responsible Mental Health.
The one of the poorest ridings in the country, Point Douglas.
And who has, as you're going to find out, a lot of lived experience that's informing the work that she's doing now, both on the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls, but also homelessness and social supports for people who are underhoused or houseless. But also, you know, given the fact that we, you know, there's a strong suspicion that the accused in this trial was stalking victims, or at least being introduced to victims at shelters and soup kitchens. It does make sense about why all these things are wrapped up into a single ministry.
That's safety and the issue of how do we get wraparound, or what we're going to talk about is wraparound approaches. But that probably the most important thing is how four walls isn't just a home. So we'll send it right over to our special conversation with Minister Bernadette Smith. I've known Bernadette for a very long period of time, back when we were both teachers in Winnipeg. You were a teacher at Maples Collegiate and then headed on to the Wayfinders program. And we got to know each other a bit during some research on that. And of course, well-known co-founder of the Manitoba Coalition of Families of Missing and Murdered Women in Manitoba. And of course, Drag the Red Initiative, but now MLA for Point Douglas. And Cabinet Minister of the Legislative Assembly. So congratulations and thanks for having coming to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Negan and Dan, for having me. I'm very honored to be here.
Well, first off, congratulations. We know that you were recently awarded the BBC. Well, I mean, the British Broadcasting Corporation named you to the top 100 women list. So that's amazing. Way to go.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing to be, just recognized as one of the top 100 women, the only one in Manitoba.
And of course, for your work on the incredible work on murder, missing Indigenous women and girls. And so it's hard to not talk a little bit about kind of the atmosphere over the past few years and here in Manitoba involving the violence on that issue. You have a very deep connection with your sister, Claudette Osborne. You've been working on this issue for such a long period of time, and your government came in talking a lot about the search of the landfill. I know that we don't really want to talk too much about something that's about to happen or forthcoming, but what's your sort of barometer of Manitoba right now on the issue of murder, missing Indigenous women and girls, and where we're at? Because certainly we've got a trial going on that's a high profile trial. We've got the issue of searching the landfill. How are you feeling right now about the way Manitoba is dealing with this issue?
Well, I think as a whole of society, I think that's got to shift, right? And I've said this time and time again, like it's not going to just take governments, it's not going to just take policing, it's got to take society as a whole to really shift how we treat one another. And I remember when Candace Dirksen went missing, I was 11 years old, and you know how impactful that was for me as a little girl to not be able to go outside to see like everyone as a community come together out searching for this little girl. And, you know, it was all over the media, in the news. You turn on the TV and that's all you would see. And, you know, I really think that we as a community and as a society need to go back to that kind of response. And it's become so normalized when someone goes missing, especially Indigenous people, that we need to not have a response where it's normalized, but a response where this is a community member, regardless of gender or ethnicity, that this is someone's loved one and this is someone who's a part of our community, and we should all care and get behind this and do something about it. And you know, come together and a response so that someone comes home to their loved one.
The pivot, though, you know, for years, I think people thought of whether it be murdered, missing Indigenous women and girls, whether it be homelessness, whether it be even poverty, people always thought of these things as kind of an Indigenous issue, right? And kind of for those of us who have been on the streets for a long time, either whether we're organizing marches or organizations or now, it's become a central issue I think all Manitobans are interested in, because now here you are in government bringing attention to this issue. What's it like to be no longer kind of outside the room and now being inside the room? What's that like to now be in the driver's seat on these really pivotal issues that you've been working outside the room for such a long period of time?
Yeah, and that's really what brought me to become involved in politics, was being on the outside, right? Lobbying, advocating, seeing what change could come from the outside to wanting to be on the inside to make that change. And, you know, growing up as a little girl in social housing, you know, growing up as a mom, you know, a single mom of two boys, being a child of a mom who, you know, was on EIA, that was a single mom growing up in social housing herself, and then going on to raise her two boys in social housing. Certainly that was something that drove me when I became a politician to wanting to make change for others. A social program under the NDP government was what helped lift me out of poverty. It was, you know, first, child and youth program. I was a child and youth and became a child and youth care provider through a program. Worked at Marymount for 12 years with kids who were like me, and through there became interested in education because there were, you know, educators who helped me. I would go in one door and out the other, and, you know, was very truant in school and didn't really see myself reflected. And when I had the opportunity to become an educator, that was something that I was really passionate about, was making sure that kids seen themselves reflected in education. So when I had that opportunity, you know, and becoming a driving force in education, it was like Aboriginal Education Leadership Group, you know, bringing Aboriginal educators together and really changing the trajectory of how we educate kids in classrooms, you know, not having Aboriginal education being an after school or lunchtime thing, but embedding it in everything that we did. You know, whether that was in gym class, because we were doing powwow club at lunchtime, right? But actually having that a part of gym class, having drum group a part of music class. Growing up, you know, our textbooks were like cowboys and Indians, you know, cowboys up on top of a horse and the Indigenous Indians down below, right? You see the power structure, right? So I grew up seeing that, singing one little, two little, three little Indians, right? And not really knowing, you know, anything in that, right? And being proud of that song. But now I know the history of that, right? So really teaching kids the colonial, you know, aspect of that, and helping educators too, to see, you know, the colonialism that's happened throughout our education system, and unpacking that and helping educators see their responsibility in helping to educate the next generation. Because a lot of new educators in our system were uneducated as well and didn't see their responsibility.
And now going into the rooms now, I mean, you have a chance to influence these educators in really profound ways for generations to come. I mean, have you seen a lot of hope the past few months being in government, like a lot of change happening very quickly?
Absolutely. I mean, you have the first First Nations premier. You have, you know, First Nations cabinet ministers. You have Métis cabinet ministers. I say to kids now, you can be what you see.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, growing up, I couldn't be what I could see, because there was no one there that I could see. Like, I grew up seeing, you know, a lot of alcoholism, a lot of violence. I didn't see a lot of people reflected that were in positions of power. I didn't see people in, I grew up in the North End, you know, Byways and Woolworths and Oretzky's. There was nobody working.
You just
talked
my
like
language
me.
There.
Yeah. Like
those grocery stores for me.
Yeah, exactly. There was nobody that was indigenous that were working. So yeah. I didn't aspire to be any of those folks, right? My relatives were like, came from the residential school system and it was very dysfunctional. And, you know, we weren't, my mom didn't know her language. My grandma only spoke her language. So I didn't take the time to learn Ojibwe, you know, and couldn't really communicate with her. And I regret that now, but I say to our kids now, take the time, you know, and I see that in our schools now. And, you know, I love that. And I say to our kids now, like, you're very fortunate to be able to learn drubbing, to be able to smudge in your schools, to be able to have role models, to be able to have elders in your schools. Like, take that opportunity, learn that. And when kids come to like the People's Building, like I'm always inviting kids to come there to see themselves reflected. And, you know, when I think about just some of the things that we're doing, like for them to aspire to be what we are, because they can do it.
So when you were, you talked about, you know, being able to see yourself in a new context, you know, getting involved in politics, your party being elected government. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say, though, that you didn't imagine that you were going to take on every pressing social
the
issue.
Biggest portfolio.
Yeah.
Of all time.
Like I've been thinking about negotiating with the comm staff to get an acronym for your portfolios. So for the record, housing, addictions, homelessness, and the minister responsible for mental health. So do you find that somewhat intimidating? Like I should say, it all makes sense when you think of the interconnections. But on the other hand, holy cow, right? Like that is a mouthful of priorities.
I was like super excited. I didn't find it intimidating because it was something that we've been talking about pushing for. And when we were in opposition, it was like something that we heard time and time again. The shelters, the three shelters are in my constituency. So every time I would visit, I would see someone who was housed. And then I would go back 6 months later, I'd see that person back there. I'd be like, how come you're back here? And they would tell me, well, you know, I was housed, but, you know, I'm housed alone. I don't have the purpose that I have when I'm in the shelter. I'm isolated, or sometimes they don't have the proper supports, right? So when we were thinking about, like, we have the opportunity to form government, like, these are some of the things that we are really looking at, making sure that people have wraparound supports, that there's different ways of housing people, right? Because people don't want to be by themselves. They want communal living. They want wraparound supports, you know, and everyone needs different supports, right? Someone might be struggling with their mental health. Someone might be struggling with addiction. Someone might be, you know, just wanting to live communally. Like everyone has different needs. And when we think about kids that are coming out of care, right, the gaps in services, like, so when we're thinking about housing, like we're thinking about it in a whole different way of that we've ever thought about housing and homelessness. Like when we're visiting in the encampments and we're talking to folks in the encampments, they're like, we have a family here. Like, we don't want to leave our family. This is like a community. So how do we take that community and keep these folks together? Because they don't want to leave each other, right? And we don't want to separate them either.
Right?
So we're starting to look at that and how do we house people differently and meet their needs.
So a week ago, almost to the day, you and some other people from the community were scheduled to make an announcement at 575 Balmoral, and the event was interrupted by a bit of tragic news, as a body was discovered in the abandoned, development at 575 that started out as a sort of a promising thing, but never, you know, it had a variety of physical and other problems. But, you know, it's hard not to look at that and say that is an incredibly powerful metaphor for the urgency of the work that you're doing. So, you know, maybe tell me the experience of having that event interrupted by that tragedy.
Yeah, it was very emotional, you know, very concerning, first of all. You know, who is this person? What had happened? You know, who's their family? That's, you know, always top of mind. Not worried about the announcement. The announcement can happen, you know, it'll happen later, right? Yeah, that was a first reaction, right? And yeah, it was just, yeah, it was very emotional, mm-hmm. you know, to learn that someone had lost their life in that space. You know, on the other hand, we think about it as, you know, it's a revitalization of the area. We think about the Balmoral Hotel and what it's becoming as well, mm-hmm. right? We have plans this week to smudge that space. We've asked an elder to come in and bring the folks who were impacted by, you know, the discovery to also come in and help with their healing as well, because that had to have impacted them mm-hmm. as well, the first responders as well, the housing staff and whoever else, you know, wanted to join in that. And then just to clear that space and send some prayers to the mm-hmm. family and the loved one as they journey on.
So the plans that you have for the space, so it was supposed to provide safe and affordable housing for new Canadian families. Physically, the project just never really lived up to expectations, and that created a whole bunch of other collateral problems. So now, $2.2 million to redevelop 30 suites. Tell me what's going to come out the other end of that investment by the province.
So the site will be totally demolished. There'll be 30 new standalone units for youth aging out of care. So, and these youth will be youth that may be with children, youth that are working towards getting their children back. They will be supported through AMC as well as Spence Neighborhood Association. And, you know, this is really exciting for us because this is going to change the trajectory of, you know, the lives of these kids. I was a kid in care. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would have benefited tremendously by something, you know, like this, having the supports mm-hmm. in a home, you know, a safe, beautiful new home with people who care about you that are helping you along your journey, whether that's, you know, getting back into school, whether that's getting into a social program such as I was in, you know, to help you, you know, move along your journey and, you know, get into the workforce, to help you get your kids back, or if you're becoming a mom, to help you with your parenting skills. It's just going to, you know, help break so many cycles because mm-hmm. we know when kids are in care that they often end up in so many other systems, right? The judicial system, missing and murdered, and, you know, so on and so forth, and homelessness.
That's what they get the encampments, right? I mean, they get the encampments is connection, yeah.
This has been like the kids aging out of care has been like one of the biggest blind spots of the social safety net, for lack of a better term. And I mean, really, I think I'm safe in saying like somehow left unaddressed by governments of all stripes. There have been efforts, but really this, you know, the idea that you get to a certain age and then you're no longer eligible to be in the foster care program. And so you're just kind of thrust out into the world. So, you know, will there be more focused on this blind spot? You know, 30 is an incredible start, but obviously I'm going to assume there's way more kids who need the help.
That is definitely something that our government is working towards. We are working, listening, and working with agencies and working with kids in care. We know that there's a huge gap there, and we see that with kids in encampments. Like we've been seeing a lot of kids that are, you know, living in encampments, that are homeless, that are living in shelters, that don't have the support. So this project speaks directly to that need and speaks directly to our commitment as a government to address that need. And certainly, you know, this is one of probably many other projects that we will be working towards filling gaps.
I mean, that's the issue here, right? Because I think the one thing that previous governments, and I would include NDP governments in this, is have misunderstood around the issue of homelessness is what many social justice organizations, the Bear Clan, the Mama Bear Clan, the Initiative 204, you know, I could list all these sort of volunteer groups that have really gotten it, or the basic premise is that people just need to be loved, or people need to be supported, and people need to know someone's there. Whereas oftentimes what governments in the past have seen is just a house, just get them a house or get them some kind of unit. And then that's somehow going to solve the issue, but that's not going to solve the issue, because what's often called wraparound supports is what the term that everybody's using these days, which is that kind of connection. And that's the challenge of children in care, which is that the way people get chronic homelessness is a lack of connection and kind of a transiency. Would you agree?
And that's why our department was created. That is our commitment. And that
sort of an
is,
interconnected approach to, yes, sort of, yeah.
Because we've identified that there is a real need and there's a real gap in terms of housing people without supports. You can't simply put a person in a home. Four walls don't make a house, right? You need to actually give them the supports that they need to get them onto a path of success. And when we talk about this path of success, and I call it the continuum of care, right? Getting people from encampments and bus shelters into a place of safety, whether that's a hotel or a shelter, from a shelter and a hotel to a stable, you know, housing with supports, whether that's social housing into private housing with rent supplements, because we always want to move people out of our social housing, because the whole idea that we're moving people into home ownership as well, into social programs, so that they can, you know, realize that they can have a job, they can be successful, they can have a car. I didn't have my first car till I was like well into my 20s. I didn't have my license till I was well into my 20s. I'm close to paying off my first mortgage. Never in my life growing up would I ever think that was a possibility, right? But when you have people who help you, support you, believe in you, and, you know, I use my own experience in the work that I'm doing, and it's possible, and that's what we're working towards.
And I think people may not realize that safety might be the predominant issue, because that kind of mental safety, or that kind of way that you have those wraparound ways that make you feel that a home is a home, which is found in the encampments. And, you know, during the pandemic, that was the number. It was almost like an assault on the downtown community. People always go, oh, there's no, we've had guests on who have said, oh, there's nobody living downtown. And we're like, oh, absolutely, there's people living downtown. You just, maybe people don't see them or don't think about them, or they're living in a bus shelters, or they're living in a tent. So the reality is that there is an issue of safety. And part of that is a chronic issue within the city. And that, therefore, is leading to big issues of trauma. The big issue, of course, is the trial that's taking place right now. And it's alleged that the individual who's been charged with the murder of Indigenous women who have ended up in landfills were out, looking into homeless shelters, hanging around homeless shelters, preying upon people who are in dire straits, not just those women, but also others as well. That's the allegation anyways. And I know you can't comment on that trial. But when we have an issue of safety, it's impacting people most directly, those who are the most disenfranchised, that issue of safety in terms of housing. How can we ensure that's a sustainable model, that we have currently the small housing project around the Thunderbird House? It's well and good to have a situation of safety and supports in and around those small homes. But then we've also got the large issue of poverty in that community. We've got issues of addictions that are within that community. And how do you, as a minister, sort of think I've got this neighborhood, but then I've also got these big issues, big ticket issues around that's going to need the cabinet, that's going to need Manitobans, that's going to need almost the federal government to really think about in a broad scale. How do you get everybody on the same page for that?
Well, we've been working a lot cross-departmentally and really trying to look at how do we come together and, you know, work together in supporting this issue, really. And it's not just a part or government, right? It's working with the agencies, working with the organizations, working with the folks who are living this, right? What do they need? And how do we meet their needs? And I talked about it earlier. So like people in encampments, they don't want to leave their encampments because they don't want to be moving by themselves. So it's like, how do we keep these folks together, housed together, so that they can stay together? So we're looking at it, reimagining what housing looks like so that we can keep folks together so that they're not leaving housing to go back to be with their community, but we're moving their community with them. In terms of addictions, you know, we're looking at our first supervised consumption site. That's never been done in Manitoba. And that's coming from folks that, you know, are living with substance use disorders that have told us they need a safe place to use. That's coming from families who have lost their lives, who have lost loved ones, that said this would have made a difference. I visited other provinces, that have supervised consumption sites. Not one person has ever lost their life in a safe consumption or supervised consumption site. They connect people with services, primary health care. A lot of the folks that are in the encampments have never had primary health care. They just don't access the services. So if they are going to a supervised consumption site, it's going to look like a one-stop shop. Like, the organizations that we're working with, like, they will have access to housing workers. A lot of them aren't even on EIA. So there'll be EIA workers there to be able to, you know, connect them with EIA supports. Again, primary health care, you know, if they're ready to stop using and want to get into treatment, they'll be able to, you know, get into treatment, onto a journey. So it's about meeting people where they're at and connecting them to the services that they need, and then getting them, you know, into their continuum of care. And I think about this as like, it's so many different levels, right?
And
people are
so
at different, yeah.
And we had John K. Sampson on talking about libraries, and that was an episode we had just a short while ago. And he sort of was saying that the library is one of the ways that we can deal with poverty and we can deal with homelessness, because so many people use the library for just accessing, contacting their families, accessing basic things like
government programs.
I mean, it will involve a big, broad scale. And I know that this is maybe an ambitious question, but it's a fair one. Several hundred thousand people did not vote for your party in Manitoba. I think that those several hundred thousand people, maybe not all of them, but certainly I think a percentage of them, may be of the opinion that nobody lives downtown. And so therefore they don't see those and might not understand that there is a need for this broad scale, big picture approach that's going to involve services that they perhaps would be impacted by. So that means we're going to have to take, for instance, EI workers, government workers. We're going to have to take services that may be in areas that are in, you know, money only goes so far. So services that are typically available in, let's say, outside of the downtown core, but put them in the downtown core. How do we get a broad scale approach from Manitobans towards the issue of affordable housing, social housing, which is going to need that wraparound approach, this big picture approach, and is probably going to upset a lot of people who think that this is a bunch of lazy people who just won't get a job?
I think we're seeing a lot of people get on board with this. I think people are starting to connect and see like that it's affecting everyone, right? We're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it in the South End. Like, there's homeless camps all over the place.
We have people at University of Manitoba. First time I've ever seen that was this year.
Yeah. So I think people are starting to see it everywhere. They realize that it's going to take everyone to help, you know, solve this, and that everyone's impacted, whether, you know, they're directly impacted or not, that it's in their communities. And unless, you know, they start to get involved, and we've seen that with the business community, right? Business community are putting money forward. They're saying, hey, we want to start to be a part of the solution. We're willing to put money forward to help build some affordable rent geared to income. And I want to use rent geared to income because that's really important. Like, what's affordable to me is not affordable to someone living in a tent, right? So they are willing to put money towards building rent geared to income units for folks to help support, you know, those who are, you know, living unsheltered, to make sure that folks have somewhere to live, right? And then we're coming in and saying, we'll partner and provide the wraparound support so that we're all coming together working communally. So we're working with the federal government, we're working with the provincial government, and we're working with the city as well. So city is providing land. And then all these different organizations and community groups are coming together. You mentioned some of them, Bear Clan, Mama Bear Clan, downtown community safety patrol. Like, everyone is just coming together, and groups like community volunteer groups, everyone is just, you know, putting their best foot forward to say, like, it's a collective response here and responsibility, and we all need to do something.
So you made an interesting point when you touched on the rent geared to income, because I personally full admission, speaking on behalf of all journalists now, but I don't think we do a good job of separating the issues of social housing for the most vulnerable and affordable housing, which affects a large constituency of people who aren't homeless, but are, they have incredible social and financial strain in their life trying to deal with the escalating costs of housing. And so, you know, I think we need to do a better job of focusing and separating those two issues to a certain extent. But as the housing minister, do those issues, like in the end with finite resources, do they compete against each other? Like, is there a tension between social housing and a broader sense of affordable housing? How do you balance those two priorities?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is like a mixed housing
approach.
And I love that mixed housing approach that's going on, because it doesn't differentiate between income. So someone that's living in the same building could be in a rent geared to income suite. Someone that's in a market rent suite could be living in the same building. Mm-hmm. And there's a mentorship, you know, aspect going on there, because someone that's, you know, maybe driving a Mercedes is living in the same building as someone who's, you know, on EIA that's struggling, but you don't know that, mm-hmm. right? And someone sees that and says, hey, I want to, you know, own that kind of car. What do you do for a living? Oh, maybe that's something I want to aspire to be. How did you, you know, what did you have to do to get into that mm-hmm. kind of job? Mm-hmm. So now maybe they start to research, and maybe that's some kind of field that they go into. We just came from an announcement in a building where it's grandparents and younger people. So there's a mentorship aspect there mm-hmm. as well. So we're looking at housing differently, right? So really looking at mentorship in housing as right. well, and a restructuring of how really, like, we're doing housing, because mixed market, I think, and the way that they're doing it is the way to go. Because if you're rent geared to income and your income, you go into all of a sudden a different category of income, you don't have to move out of your suite. You just start paying a different rent, right. and then somebody else comes into that rent geared to income, a different suite.
So it's interesting, again, more of a personal view that you should feel under no obligation to adopt, but I think our demands on subsidized or rent geared to income suites as part of larger developments have been completely insufficient. Like we, you know, it'll start at 15% and then, you know, construction inflation might kick in and the developer negotiates government down to 8%. And like there's just, you know, and I'm not saying it's easy to build something in this day and age, but, you know, clearly, you know, we really, really only have a smattering of truly affordable housing in a lot of developments that have received government money. Do you feel, with this new model or this, not a new model, but a different approach, can you make greater demands on the developers, whether they're private, not-for-profit or private sector, to increase that, the percentage of subsidized or geared to income?
We have. We've also incentivized it more. So there's incentives of $8,500 versus $13,500. So if you're going to do a subsidized unit, you're going to get $13,500 versus non-subsidized, which is $8,500. Mm-hmm. So, you know, more folks are taking the higher subsidy because they want to be a part of the solution, right? So
yeah,
we really want to incentivize people wanting to be a part of, you know, helping to create, you know, better lives for people here in Manitoba. And we've really been saying to our private partners that, like, it's going to take all of us to really support our folks that are unhoused and create a more just community.
Yeah.
Right? Because when they're doing well, we're all going to do well. And we need to do this collectively.
So among your other responsibilities is mental health and addictions. Like no easy jobs for you, clearly. I don't know who you know, pissed off. But, you know, recently in Toronto City Council, they had a very interesting debate where a motion was put forward that mental health and addictions be declared the fourth arm of emergency response. So police, fire, paramedical, response, ambulance, and then a fourth arm of emergency response would be specifically mental health and addictions, because mental health and addictions really spans, you know, like when it manifests in medical, urgency, then it's, paramedics and fire. When it manifests in a volatile reaction, then you tend to see police. There's enormous funding implications, obviously. Toronto City Council declined to pass the resolution, but the debate continues. Can you, you know, without making any promises about funding, but do you actually see some sense in that debate and that possibly, you know, in the future, we do need to have a dedicated fourth, you know, arm of emergency response?
Well, we do have some crisis response teams here in Manitoba that do respond to mental health crises. We do have a lot of teams that are working on the addictions front. Mm-hmm. We are working towards a more integrated model instead of like the RAM clinics. We do have a digital front door. Mm-hmm. So we are working at like opening up more modes of people being able to access services. We're also working on easier ways to access mental health in terms of like going on the internet, mm-hmm. a one-stop shop. Right now, if you go on there, like you have to go all over. So, you know, we're working on making it more accessible. Certainly there's more work to do, mm-hmm. in terms of supporting people and helping people to navigate and get the services that they need quicker and sooner.
I think the complaint that you hear from people working in mental health and addictions, though, is that too much taxpayer resources are being spent on dealing with the wreckage, the aftermath, that the upstream work that needs to be done is treated as a kind of add-on to police, add-on to paramedical medicine, whereas a fourth fully funded stream then brings it, you know, the resources in. So, you know, again, I'll kind of ask the question in a different way, but I think the secret behind the suggestion is the fact that we have lived for too long without enough resources. So all the things that you described are totally positive and completely inadequate for the size of the problem. So the question is, if not by declaring it a fourth wing, when do you think we're going to see resources from all levels of government that meet the size of the problem provide that upstream assistance?
Yeah, I think you're seeing what you're seeing is a commitment from our government, definitely, like pulling together mm-hmm. this department and putting it into one has certainly, you know, signaled a commitment from us to say that this is important, that this is something that we recognize as something that needs, you know, more attention. And we know that, you know, there's not one person, you know, across this province that has not struggled with their mental health, you know, including myself, you know, everyone has struggled with mental health. We know that addictions, you know, is something that is, you know, a crisis, pervasive. At a crisis yep. level. And, you know, opening up our first supervised consumption site here in our province, we're working towards getting 2 drug testing machines online here in our province and more to come so that folks have access to that. Certainly more mental health supports for our youth as well as our adults and, you know, working with Shared Health and our team there and frontline workers, you know. And again, it's a cross-department approach and how do we support and meet people where they're at and looking at the gaps, right? And how do we fill those gaps and ensure that we're getting the supports where they're needed? And we're about 6 months in and really identifying and looking at what we can do better with what we have and where can we make sure that we can do more and better.
I mean, all of this is a kind of integrated approach that might be new. It's going to take time. We've covered on the podcast the kind of we talk about politics, we talk about previous governments, the promises previous governments have made, and then some of the challenges that have been created, sort of often governments making a promise and then in one way or another, perhaps either being seen as not delivering on it or on then coming back to come up in an election campaign. One of the biggest parts of the platform of the NDP campaign was to end chronic homelessness in 2 terms. You're describing an approach that would need a number of factors. One is everybody on board, even those who perhaps have a diametrically opposed opinion on whether this issue is even an issue at all. Second is there is the issue of, you know, one of the things that you did starting is the stop the sale of what the previous government was doing, which was selling a lot of the Manitoba housing properties. Many of those properties need a lot of renovation, a lot of commitment, a lot of, I know because I hear about this often from readers who write me an email about some problem in Manitoba housing and want me to do something about it. So a lot of attention, nurturing, time. Do you think that's a promise that may be a dangerous one to make? I'm thinking of the previous, you know, a few numbers of governments ago, an NDP government promised to end hallway medicine. They did not do that. In fact, it was a rather silly promise to make because of a whole bunch of reasons involving the way hospitals operate and the ways that hallways are still being used to administer care and so on. Do you think that promising to end chronic homelessness is a dangerous promise, whereas it's going to take perhaps even longer than maybe 2 terms?
I have every confidence that we can end chronic homelessness in the next 2 terms. The way that we're continuing to build housing, the way that we're continuing to partner on, you know, with our levels of government, with our community partners, with our business community, our nonprofits, we are continuing to support and meet people where they're at, wraparound supports. I think that is what we need to continue to do. Providing people with the social supports that they need in order to, you know, get out of the cycles that they've continued to be in is like a key factor in the continuum of care. And connecting people, I think, with the supports that they need is like a real key. And, you know, housing, of course, is a real barrier to, you know, what we want to do. But That is what we're going to continue to do, is build housing, create partnerships to get housing built. And, you know, we talked about deeply affordable, rent geared to income housing, also market rent, because people are going to move up in housing and be able to afford market rent, which opens up other housing for other people to be able to access. So we are, it's an ambitious goal, but it's a goal that we are going to meet, and we are going to continue to support people where they're at. And, it's going to take everyone, but I think people are ready, and they're willing, and they want to help, and they want everyone to be doing well. And we can't all do well unless everyone's doing well. So,
yeah, well, you know, certainly, 8 years from now, when we're in like the 10th season of the Negan and the Lone Ranger podcast, we're going to have you back.
We're going to have t-shirts by then, too. That's a promise.
And coffee mugs. And no, we're definitely going to have you back in 8 years to see how this has gone. So that's a promise.
We're going to follow up on this. You know, I mean, and the initial results seem to be producing. I mean, certainly there's a lot of people who've been speaking positively of this approach, and Homelessness Winnipeg is probably the one who comes quickly to mind in the report that they released recently of the kind of units. There's 1,500 units needed, and they're about halfway to that mark. So certainly there's some promising trends. I think that I would love to see the Manitobans pay more attention to this issue. So the fact that we're spending a whole hour of the pod talking about it, I think, is evidence that people are talking about it more. And certainly I hope that there's more of a message that it is, that it's about everybody, and it's about trying to bring it, produce the success for everybody.
Yeah. And, no, I think it needs to be a lot more than just, I can't afford the mortgage on my house in White Ridge. Which is, you know, I'm not saying that's not a problem.
That's dominating the feds,
though. Yeah, but that, yeah. So I think, I do appreciate the fact that you guys, your entry point has been, you know, in the areas of greatest need. Center Village. Yep. 30 new units.
We are super happy about Center Village. We're also super happy about our maintenance of our existing housing, because that's something that, you know, as I was in opposition, I would drive by and, you know, look at our social housing boarded up. And when I became minister, I was like, we need to get those boards off those units. And that's something that we're doing in getting people into those units and people housed and with support. So I'm very, you know, very happy and excited to, you know, work with everyone and anyone to get our folks housed and get them the supports that they need and get them onto a path of success.
Well, I want to say a big me gotcha for coming on the podcast, but I also want to say this is not an easy time. It's not an easy time, I think, for all of us. Any person who is closely touched by the issue of murder, missing Indigenous women and girls, particularly during this trial, but also during this issue of involving the searching of the landfill. And I think the atmosphere in Manitoba is one that's very sensitive at the moment. And I know that you've been personally touched by this, but coming to talk about issues that clearly are about your childhood, about your life, and also about not just your job, but also your passion. Big me gwech for coming on the pod for today.
Me gwech for having me.
Yep. Thanks also CJNU and Adam Glynn, as usual, Winnipeg Free Press, Paul Simon, and others.
Many others that
Wendy,
help us.
Wendy, you're in there too. I know you don't listen to the end of the podcast, Wendy, but you get thanked all the time. That'll get her. Anyways, yeah, no, thanks to everybody, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Yep, me gwech.